You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 124, and Communications Workers, Local 6360. The IBEW supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you are not finding your electrical contractor at IBEWlocal124.org, then you are not getting the best value for your money. And the Communications Workers of America, Local 6360, represents workers at AT&T, Lantel Communications, Rogers Printing, E2 Embroidery, Mood Media, and 911 dispatchers for the City of Independence and for Jackson County. We work every day to protect workers' rights. Buying union-made products helps us all keep good jobs. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, Kansas City workers, do you have a boss at your job making your daily life a living hell? Never fear. On tonight's show, we'll discuss bad bosses and how to deal with them. We're conducting a class on the radio, which will give you the tools you need to fight back on the job. In the news, the Star's Dave Helling gets some facts wrong on right to work, and unions react to Trump's partial ban on Muslim refugees and visitors. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. She'll talk about what OSHA might look like under Trump. Now for the news. The news from our side. Today's Kansas City Star featured an opinion piece by new editorial board member Dave Helling, titled, Right to Work Will Force Organized Labor to Look in the Mirror. Already, a number of groups have complained about the rightward tilt of the Star's editorial page, but Helling's column raises a question deeper than his political orientation. It's the same question put to Donald Trump's press secretary, Sean Spicer, when he admitted he is challenged by facts. Spicer told us that the new word for lie in the Trump administration is alternative fact. Well, Helling's piece on right to work has at least two alternative facts. First, one that is straight out of the megaphone of the National Right to Work Committee, that somehow in Missouri, union membership is compulsory. In fact, if Helling had bothered to fact check, this simply isn't true. In a series of Supreme Court cases culminating in the 1988 Beck decision, compulsory union membership and payment of dues other than the direct cost of representation has been outlawed. In Missouri, you do not have to join a union, and if you choose not to, you do not have to pay the full dues. However, what Helling doesn't bother to explain is that even if you don't join, the union, as the sole bargaining agent for the workers, is still obligated to represent you for which services it has been able to collect a fee. Now, with the passage of a so-called right to work law, the union will have to represent non-members for free, even if they are problem employees who constantly ask the union to defend them in grievance and arbitration, a rather costly procedure. Second, after Helling admits that Hillary Clinton carried union households by 8%, he misleadingly says union men and women voted for Donald Trump. True, many did, but not a majority. The implication is that it's the unself-reflective union leaders who are at fault for not getting their message out, but Helling never mentions the deluge of money from building supply millionaire David Humphreys, who dumped over $14 million into Missouri races, including $100,000 to Representative Holly Rader, the House sponsor of the Right to Work bill, and $250,000 to send Senator Dan Brown, sponsor of the Senate Right to Work bill. Finally, Humphreys and family donated $2,275,000 to new Governor Eric Greitens, who has promised to sign Right to Work. Maybe it's all Missourians who need to look in the mirror and ask how they've allowed their ethics and government to drown in such a deep pool of money.
And PAI reports the presidents of two big unions, Mary Kay Henry of the Service Employees and Randy Weingartner of the American Federation of Teachers, are taking the lead against Republican President Donald Trump's nomination of federal appellate judge Neil Gorsuch to the vacant seat in the U.S. Supreme Court. And National Nurses United is not far behind. And it's both the unions and independent analysis from Harvard Law School and other sources show workers and their allies should be concerned if Gorsuch, 49, joins the bench. That's because the Supreme Court seats are the lifetime posts, with justices staying for decades. Union opposition to Gorsuch began usually moments Trump unveiled the judge as the Supreme Court pack in the night of January 31st. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka said Judge Gorsuch does not seem to appreciate the issues and challenges facing working families and the importance of upholding and enforcing our rights. His ruling to date raises very serious concerns about where he stands on issues like workers' health and safety, equal opportunity to the workplace, and the ability of agencies to adopt rules for protecting workers' rights. Both Henry and Weingartner, a longtime New York City high school history and civics teacher, said Gorsuch would substitute his own strategy for the U.S. Constitution that could spell trouble for workers. And the National Nurses United President Deborah Berger, RN, urged Democrats to filibuster, talk to death the nomination. Oregon's Jeff McCleary plans to do it. Gorsuch's record raises significant concerns about the ability to be fair and to respect and follow the law rather than his own ideology, including repeatedly taking the side of corporations over consumers and workers. And Weingartner said, Berger added that Gorsuch rulings show that consistent hostile to the rights and protections of workers, working people.
This from Barb Kusser of Workday, Minnesota. Opposition to Republican President Donald Trump's policies and executive orders spread across the country as the controversial chief executive banned Muslims from seven selected nations from entering the U.S. and threatened to cut off funds to sanctuary cities that help and shield undocumented people. In Minnesota, teachers' unions were the most vocal against Trump's executive order, but so too was AFSCME Minnesota Council 5 with 43,000 workers. They noted the state's foreign-born population includes more than 31,000 people from the seven Muslim nations that Trump targeted. It's difficult to determine how many immigrants in Missouri there are from the seven countries Trump named. As for the number of Muslims here in Kansas City, one article from 2013 estimated there are 20,000. Of course, many are not immigrants and most probably don't come from the countries on Trump's list. On January 28th, the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, which represents 19,000 drivers in New York City, held a one-hour strike to protest the ban. When Uber tried to take advantage of the strike, many people canceled their Uber accounts. The next night, the ban was a big topic of the nationally televised Screen Actors Guild After Awards, where unionized actors marched to the podium to protest. And protests erupted at airports around the country, including Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, Chicago's O'Hare Airport, Washington's Dulles International Airport, and New York's JFK International, the focus of the taxi worker strike. Service Employees President Mary Kay Henry said in a statement, "America has a long history of welcoming immigrants, including our Muslim brothers and sisters, to our shores, and they are an essential part of what makes our country strong. Scapegoating families who are trying to provide for their children undermines American values." Auto Workers President Dennis Williams issued a statement saying, "We are a nation of immigrants, and our union would not exist if immigrants and non-immigrants alike hadn't fought in solidarity for the rights that we cherish today. We must protect national security while remaining true to the very values that have made us a great nation. The UAW opposes discrimination of any kind and denounces any policy that judges people based on their religion or nation of origin." And as an aside with that, Uber Technologies Chief Executive Officer Travis Kalanick, today facing criticism from immigration advocates for serving on Donald Trump's business advisory group, quit the group on Thursday.
The AFL-CIO has a new, almost daily news service called The Labor Wire. It's mostly tweet size. Here's a sample from Tuesday. "Isn't the third time supposed to be the charm? Andrew Putzer, confirmation hearing as Labor Secretary, has been delayed for the fourth time. And like Politico reported this morning, it's not clear when the damn thing will be scheduled. To subscribe to The Labor Wire, email igoltz@aflcio.org. The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel, Lon Swearing, Jen Zeman, Molly Madden.
And it's Pledge Week at KKFI. This is Judy Ansel. I guess you call me the executive producer of the Heartland Labor Forum. And so I want to ask all of our listeners out there if they would do what Dave Pennington just did and make a pledge to KKFI and to the Heartland Labor Forum. We want to thank Dave for his pledge, and he said he is challenging union members and Teamsters and sustaining members to do like him and make a pledge. And if you want to do that, you can call 888-931-0901. We've got people standing by, and they will take your pledge. Or if you want to do it online, you can go to kkfi.org. So support the Heartland Labor Forum, support KKFI, support alternative media. God knows we need it these days.
Yeah, not alternative facts, alternative media.
Right, that's right. No alternative facts here, just alternative media. So 888-931-0901. And now I'm turning it over to Tino for a very unusual show tonight.
And good evening, and welcome back to, like Judy said, a very special edition of the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi. Tonight, for one full hour, we're going to have bad bosses and how to deal with them, a Labor Notes tutorial. Joining us on the phone is Labor Notes Associate Director Leah Freed. Leah is going to give you a brief tutorial on what to look out for in your own place of business and how you can deal effectively and collectively with renegade and abusive members of management. Then later on in the program, we have Eric Foreman. Eric's a public school teacher in the city of New York and a longtime activist and organizer. He's going to tell us about the initial stages of organizing a worker-run cafe and why, in his opinion, we may not need bosses at all. And finally, joining us for the first time in the KKFI studio is veteran auto worker and revolutionary storyteller Vincent Sorrentino. Okay, first, let's go to Leah. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, Leah.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, I know before teaming up with Labor Notes that you were an organizer with the United Electrical Workers, and you kind of maybe helped the employees of a door and windows factory in Chicago take over their plant. Can you tell us?
Yeah, that was a couple of times.
Well, can you?
We occupied the factory of Republic Windows and Doors.
Yeah, can you tell us in like 2 minutes or less what bad boss move might have triggered that action, and maybe answer what in the hell you were thinking?
Well, in the case of UE Local 1110, which was the union at Republic Windows and Doors, which I worked with when I was an organizer with UE. You know, the variety, I guess, of bad boss that we were coming up against were the liars and the cheaters. And this was I'm sure many people have heard this saying that the only time, you know, they're telling the truth is when their lips aren't moving, kind of boss. So,
right.
You know, for many months, there had been some suspicious things happening, production lines being rearranged, and at one point, a whole line disappeared out of the factory, things being moved in the middle of the night, and for about a month, we had like a 24-hour watch on the factory to make sure they didn't take anything out. And then they announced that they were going to close and that they were going to close with only 3 days' notice. And that really prompted people to feel like they had nothing to lose and they might as well sit in until they got what they were owed. And, of course, the real story here is that when you're organized in a union and you've been fighting grievances, fighting for contracts, fighting for fairness on the job, you get a lot of practice, and you know how to fight really well. So these were workers who had engaged in struggle for about 5 years, and when the time came, they were ready to take further action and sit down and take the factory. And we occupied that factory for 6 days and ended up getting a settlement of what they were owed under the law. But, of course, the factory still closed. And then because of the publicity that those workers got, they were able to find someone else to buy the factory and reopen it, and about 75 of the 300 folks worked at Sirius Materials for a few years, and then they announced they would close, and we occupied again. And this time we insisted that the workers be able to buy it. We're not playing with bosses anymore, because these were bosses that were disorganized and clueless and never completed anything that they said they were going to do, and they couldn't run the factory. So at this point, you know, we occupied for the second time, and it was 2012, and we won an agreement that said if the workers could buy it, they would sell it to the workers, and then we joined up with the working world to raise the funds, which is a co-op incubator organization, and then those folks a year later opened a factory called New Era Windows, and they just sold $1.3 million worth of windows in 2016. So it's a thriving business with no bosses.
That's amazing. So I guess the lesson to take away from that is that if you have a bad boss and they're getting ready to shut down your factory, you can just do what the good people at Republic Doors and Windows did and just take over the factory.
Well, certainly. I encourage people to engage in peaceful nonviolence. And in this case, it was civil disobedience because, as you know, sit-down strikes were declared illegal many, many years ago. But, you know, when there is strength, you can eventually win and negotiate a good settlement, and that's what these workers did, and now they own their own factory. Of course, it's a much smaller factory, and of course, we recognize not everybody is going to be able to occupy and take over.
Sure.
But a lot of people have bad bosses. So what do you do when you have just a bad boss?
Please.
So I want to challenge your listeners and union members everywhere to think of a bad boss, and whether it's like an abusive, harassing boss, like a bully, or like a Trump boss, or if it's, you know, the boss that lies to your face and smiles at you, or it's the boss who's incompetent and doesn't get anything done and never gives you an answer to your grievance or any other issue that comes up. Mm-hmm. Regardless of what type of bad boss you have, look at that bad boss as an organizing opportunity. See it as a time to really rally the troops. And I think if you look at what's happening in this country around Trump's executive orders and his hateful rhetoric and his insane speech, it really has, motivated a lot of people to get out in the streets like they haven't before. And so if we look at that as an example, we can see in our own workplaces, when there's a bad boss, organize people around that bad boss. Use that bad boss as an opportunity to unite workers and fight.
So I hope everybody in Kansas City and around the nation and whoever's listening right now live streaming it is getting this wisdom from Leah Fried. And so in addition to that, so the lesson that we've learned is that a bad boss can actually help organize a workforce. Nothing can bring a workplace together like a bad boss. And so, you know, they come in all shapes and sizes. Some are aggressive, where mm-hmm. others might act more reasonable. Some are friendly, others not so friendly. And so, but what, in your opinion, your expert opinion, what is the tie that binds all of these different styles of management together? What is the motivating thing behind them, especially when it comes in terms of their employees?
No. Well, what I would say is what they all have in common, regardless of their personality, is a lack of respect for the people that they work with and the people who make that company run. So, or that firm, or that nursing home, or that, you know, service,
right.
Or that, you know, restaurant, whoever, they don't treat you like a human being. So what do you do when you want to organize people around this bad boss? So there's a couple of things that I always listen for and think about when I come in contact with a bad boss, and it happens often, let me tell you. So one thing I do is I pay close attention to the things that they say, and I take notes, and then I go and I take the things that are so disrespectful and so insulting, and I put it in a leaflet. And I do, you know, ex-boss said, quote, you're all a bunch of lazy bums and don't deserve anything. Whatever they say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or I wish I was more like Donald Trump and I hate immigrants. I've heard a boss say that too. So, you know, whatever they say, use their words, use their own words against them to share with your coworkers the kind of things that they're saying to you in a grievance meeting, or maybe in a production meeting, but make sure that it is denounced and that we have to stop this person. And so sign the petition, let's do a march on the boss, file a group grievance or a class action grievance, whatever you call it, and you know, think about wearing stickers or buttons that say, we deserve respect now, or whatever message that, you know, resonates with your workforce. But there's a lot of ways that you can take what the bad boss does, take it out to your coworkers, and then organize them to unite and take action and really pressure this person. The other thing is, think about, does your boss have a boss? And even though your boss's boss probably doesn't care about you necessarily, they do care about getting the work done. And so making your boss's boss, giving them this crisis, delivering a crisis to their doorstep about how horrible your supervisor is,
sure.
is really going to not be something they want to deal with. So, you know, think about your target when you do that. If the bad boss is the owner of the company, for example, or the top executive, then you really just need to make their lives miserable until they realize they have to change their behavior. Just fight them.
I can think of several examples right now in my own head. Actually, I've got, you know, all five of my fingers on my left hand are filled up with bosses that I can think of immediately that sort of fit that profile. And you know what sort of strikes me is just sort of this question here, like, so how is it that a company can impose almost dictatorial rule, total domination over a workforce? You know, the thing about it is we're talking about workers. We're talking about willful, live, sentient beings capable of thinking mm-hmm. critically. And I'm no doctor,
exactly.
but psychologically, how
and
is
yet,
that possible?
Yeah. And the reality is the only reason that there is a dictatorship in your workplace is because workers let it happen. Obviously, the law doesn't help us and all those other things, but at the end of the day, it's because we put up with it, because we accept it. So let me talk a minute, too, about some things that are disturbing and shouldn't be accepted and
yeah.
some challenges when dealing with a bad boss. So let's say you have a bad boss who's particularly bad to only a group of workers. Let's say it's a really racist boss and picks on black workers or picks on Latino workers. How do you unite people who aren't in the picked on group to support their workers? Well, you got to talk to them. Go to them and say, this guy says this, it's really insulting, and he's doing it to divide us so that we can't do better as a group. Mm-hmm. Really think about reaching out and trying to address it. Don't think that it's just a small problem that affects five people in this department. Make it everybody's issue. What if you have a boss who likes to sexually harass women? That's very common. Make sure that the men understand that that's not okay and they need to support the women in challenging this guy. Sometimes that requires like a little extra work at your union meeting to talk about it. You really have to overcome any kind of personal issues that people have with each other.
Sure.
But when you focus on that boss and how that boss is bad to me and he's going to be bad to you if he hasn't been already, then you can unite people and overcome some of those barriers that exist among workers.
Well, do you think that it's possible that, let's say that the normal channels for either filing a grievance or the traditional channels of redress are either not available or perhaps they're just not very responsive? Is this something that workers can actually take on themselves without going through the proper I'm not really sure how that works.
Yeah, so, well, let's be honest. There are some unions where, you know, it's kind of bureaucratic and maybe your business agent isn't available to you or shows up once a month or is really chummy with the boss, unfortunately, because sometimes that happens, unfortunately. But doesn't mean that you can't organize. You don't need to wait for someone to tell you to do that it's okay to take action. If you think what is happening is unfair and other people agree with you, then organize. Don't wait for anyone to tell you it's okay. Now, obviously, it's best when you have a union where workers have elected representatives that are rank-and-file members of that workplace and are trained on how to file grievances and are used to organizing their coworkers around those issues in the workplace. But if that doesn't happen, don't let that stop you from talking to your coworkers about this bad boss and saying, we got to do something. What are we going to do? Come up with something creative. Do something that you all agree on. That's all that matters is that you act together.
That's exactly what it is that we need to be doing. You mentioned something earlier about laws that were passed and Donald Trump and this administration that's coming in, these morally bankrupt power brokers who, you know, they just incredible disdain for common people, and it's without historical precedent or modern peer. Membership in labor unions is the lowest that it's ever been, and Democratic participation is even lower than that. There was a bill that was passed at the Michigan State Assembly that essentially criminalizes traditional picket activity. You know, how do we put a stop to some of those bigger issues? We've got our shop floor actions as well, but then we also have some of the larger questions. And you were talking to me before about the right to work legislation that in at the national level.
I got introduced by Steve King and Joe Wilson, co-sponsors of this bill that just got introduced in the U.S. Congress to make right to work or right to shirk or right to work, no rights at work. I mean, there's a lot of right to work for less. There's a lot of ways to frame it that's a little bit more accurate than right to work. So let's call it right to shirk. Essentially, for those who don't know, obviously in Missouri, folks are very familiar with this fight, but, you know, it basically allows workers to freeload. And while unions are required to represent everybody in a workplace, this law says you don't got to pay for those services, which is amazing because imagine if, you know, there was a law passed that said that I have the option to pay for my coffee at Dunkin' Donuts or not. How many people would just go in and get free coffee? I mean, it's a freeloading, it's un-American. But let me just say, and I think this fighting in your workplace builds the unity that you need to overcome any kind of attack that your union is under, whether it's right to work, which is essentially a divide and conquer tactic. I mean, it was created in 1947 by white supremacists who believed that white and black workers united in a union was a real danger to white supremacy and white power, especially in the South. And that's why Southern states immediately, all white legislatures under Jim Crow, immediately voted to go right to work. But it's a divide and conquer tactic that is being applied to all of us now, and we need to just fight to maintain unity. And the best way to do that is to engage in fights in the workplace, to just talk to each other, say we've got to stay in the union if your state is changing, if your state is already under these regulations, or if you're in the public sector or federal employees who have this imposed on them. You know, just ask people to join, talk to them about why it matters. You know, make sure you keep track of it and make sure that people know who's a member and who isn't a member.
Leah,
and finally,
engage
in the broader social justice movement.
Yeah, I hate to cut you off right there, but I wanted to give listeners a resource for finding you online so they can find you at labornotes.org. Is that correct?
That's right. Find me at labornotes.org. You're going to find a lot of great articles written. But Labor Notes also does training. So if your local needs some help figuring out how to prepare for a right to work or any other, maybe organizing or dealing with bad boss, I do a workshop called Dealing with Difficult Supervisors. If you need consulting work, we have this program. I call it Rent a Cadre, where an experienced organizer can come and spend some time really doing either strategic planning or helping you carry out a contract campaign. So there's a lot of resources that Labor Notes can offer to your local union or your national union or your region that people should take advantage of.
Thank
and
you.
And certainly going to the website is a great place to start.
Thank
and
you so much, Leah. I appreciate it so much.
As a successful organizer.
Thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sorry we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, it was great talking to you.
Welcome to Heartland.
And everybody should pledge.
Yeah, thanks again.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, executive producer of the Heartland Labor Forum, asking you to support KKFI, your community radio station, where you hear radio like you never heard it before. So, when was the last time you talked to someone about what you heard on Democracy Now? Last week? Yesterday? Truth is, Amy Goodman improves your conversation. She makes you better informed, smarter, and even more popular. Think about it. How blah your conversation would be if she goes silent. Eek! We can't let that happen. If you want entertainment and information that you cannot get anywhere else, if you share KKFI's mission, then call us at 888-931-0901 and make your pledge today. That's 888-931-0901. Or, if you prefer, go online to kkfi.org and make your pledge there. Call now, 888-931-0901.
And I want to thank H. Lon Swearingen, who responded to Dave Pennington's challenge to union members and made a pledge, as did Molly Madden. And you, too, can make a pledge, 888-931-0901. Pledge the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI.
And we're back again on the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi, and we are joined in the studio for the very first time in the KKFI studio with veteran auto worker, revolutionary storyteller, one of my dearest friends at the Ford Motor Company since I've started there. Since 1993, Mr. Sorrentino has lent his considerable expertise to building trucks and cars for the Ford Motor Company, first in his home state of New Jersey, and then following the closing of the Edison Assembly Plant in 2003, Kansas City Assembly, where he now works as a final inspector. And so, Vinny, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's get you a little bit closer to that microphone there so everyone can hear you. So, Vinny, you and I met for the first time in 2005 in the trim department, in the passenger department, in an area that was called The Loop.
The Loop, yep. That was a very special area in trim. Kind of was a lot of what they would refer to as problem people, but people who were really building a way of fighting jobs, sticking together, and knowing how if one of us had a problem, we all had a problem. So that became a real pain for management. They didn't know how to deal with if we want to punish this one person, 10 other people are going to stand up and say, no, you can't punish that person. It makes it real difficult on management when they can't separate us and treat us just as we want to punish one at a time,
sure,
and the whole area just fights back.
It, you know, and we didn't always have that. You know, I mean, sometimes, I think of now working at Ford Motor Company, it seems like sometimes I'm just in it all by myself. But there was something very special going on back there.
It built too, because when people that you wouldn't think would join in and battle, they gave their all at times, and they stuck up for even issues that didn't affect them. If you're under a rebalance and you didn't have something added to your job, but the guy across the line or down the line from you had something at his job, you still fought. You kept the foreman off that guy. You knew how to distract him. There was techniques used where the foreman wouldn't be allowed to get to that guy to make his life miserable because we were busy making the foreman's life miserable.
Right, right, right. And, you know, I can speak on how that made me feel. You know, one, it made me feel – so also at the time when I came back there, I was new. I didn't know you. I didn't know a lot of the guys back there. There was a former president of our local union, Jerry Klein. We called him Bear, who was back there. And I felt very, you know, very lucky. And I felt like for the first time in a really long time, I wasn't alone. Did it make you feel the same way?
Yeah, it absolutely did. You could see that you were a team, that we all stood for one thing. We didn't have the attitude like, well, it could get worse. Let's just be quiet and take whatever they give us. We stood up, no, let's make it better. We didn't wait for it could get worse.
Right, right. And, you know, also these friendships and these partnerships that we developed on the line, can you tell me about your relationship that you had with your fellow workers? I mean, I know that you and I became close almost immediately. We started sharing coffee and conversations, but
These guys that we worked with on the loop for years, now we're pretty much scattered throughout the plant. We're all getting older towards the end of our careers. But most of these people I still talk to on almost a daily basis, at least a couple times a week. We still chat about the old days, how fun they were, how we were in combat constantly. But I still talk to these people. I consider them friends. I guess I'm some of the best friends I ever had.
You know, we've only got and so unfortunately, I wish we could really get into this because we've got about a million stories that we could probably tell here. We've only got about three more minutes left. Is there a specific incident that you can remember involving a member of management and a worker or a group of workers that maybe we can use as an example or a lesson to other workers?
Well, we had one instance during a rebalance. They were trying to eliminate a job on the guy down the line from me. And by doing that, they wanted me to pick up part of the job. And to do that, they wanted me to wear an apron with parts stuffed in it. And I knew if I wore it, my friend down the line would lose his job and he'd be kicked out of the area. Every day, the foreman would give me this apron to wear. I'd put it on. I'd pretend to do the job. At the end of the day, I'd throw that apron away. The next day, he said, well, where's your pouch? Where's your apron? I said, I don't know. It's gone. He'd give me another one. After about six or seven aprons disappearing, he told me to lock this one in my locker. I said, I'm not going to do that. Because that's Ford Motor Company property. If I put it in my personal locker, you can fire me for stealing property. He goes, well, I'm giving it to you. I said, I just don't accept ownership of it. You lock it in your locker. I'm not taking it. And they surrounded me by labor management, by superintendents, and they said, we're tired of you. You're going to do what you're told. You're going to wear this apron. You're going to do your job. I turned to my committee person. I said, if that apron doesn't fit me properly, it slips down, which it does. It wasn't adjusted. I'm a big man. It wouldn't fit on me tightly. It'll cause a trip hazard. They're endangering my personal safety. They're not allowed to do that. I don't have to endanger my safety, do I? My cameraman said, no, you don't. I said, well, then that's not the end of it, is it? And they agreed.
And so you won.
I won, definitely.
So there's a lesson to Kansas City workers, whether you're organized or whether you are not organized. Vinny, I want to thank you so much for sharing that story. Maybe we can do a million of these in the future and record all of these events that took place in the loop at Ford Motor Company. And so, yes, I want to thank you again. Yes. Joining us on the phone to talk about his experiences in organizing is longtime activist and organizer and writer, New York City public school teacher Eric Foreman. Eric began his organizing work in service and retail, and following that took a position teaching for a brief time in the People's Republic of China. He's a regular contributor to In These Times magazine and is active in various political struggles in the city of New York, where he is now a school teacher. Here's Eric in a pre-recorded segment talking about his latest project, a worker-run cafe at the City University of New York.
Previous life, I was fired for union organizing from Starbucks. And it turns out this has actually happened to quite a few people.
Oh, wow.
And so one dream I've always had is to create a place, create a living example of what a worker democracy would look like in the coffee industry. And to create a place that people could get a job if they were someone who'd been fired for union organizing, or maybe somebody coming out of prison, or somebody who, you know, was discriminated against on another basis and was having a hard time finding work. So I've been working with some students at the City University of New York to open up a worker co-op cafe.
Interesting.
Which will hopefully start operating later this spring. Yeah.
Now, is there some sort of organization that you had to contact? So you were talking to students and other faculty people about, hey, let's start this worker co-op coffee shop. When you had that idea, so rather than having, you know, having to deal with a bad boss, you just decided, well, we're just not going to have any bosses at all. And so once you had that idea, how did you know where to go? I mean, is there an organization?
Our group was really lucky to get accepted into something called the Green Worker Cooperative Academy. So this is a nonprofit in the Bronx that where I live, which trains workers to open their own businesses. And so we've gone through their course, and we're also working with the Murphy Institute Center for Community and Worker Ownership.
Uh-huh.
Murphy Institute Community Worker Ownership Program, CWOP, which I'm guessing you're supposed to pronounce co-op. We've been working with those two groups, and they've been helping us with the process.
I think that people would be surprised to learn that in a successful business enterprise can actually flourish without a boss.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one reason I think I got interested in doing that is I always noticed back when I was working at Starbucks that the place just seemed to work, and actually every place I've worked, the place just seemed to run a lot better when the boss wasn't there. I'm sure other people have noticed that.
Yeah, right.
People are relaxed,
yeah.
And, you know, you can just be honest about what you're thinking, what you're feeling, what you need to do the job.
Sure.
And stop doing all the stuff you just do to impress your boss, right?
Right.
Just be real. And also, economically speaking, if you don't have to pay the boss's salary and you don't have to put money in the pockets of the shareholders,
right?
You can have lower prices, higher quality, and higher wages for workers, or some combination of those things. So economically, very possible. We're going to be able to buy coffee beans from producer cooperatives, coffee cooperatives, so that we won't be unlike Starbucks, which buys its beans from, you know, highly exploitative corporate producers.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that about a business actually running more smoothly without a boss. In the very few instances where in the Ford Motor Company, we never don't have some boss or several levels of bosses on the assembly line, but those very brief periods of time where there's actually no supervision for several hours or maybe at the best a day, it seems that, yeah, things run more smoothly. Everyone's more calm. Everyone's, sort of helping out. And we have our own ideas about how we want things to work. And quite honestly, the knowledge base that it takes to run an auto factory, I mean, we really have all those skills ourselves. And really, it seems to me that management is sort of extraneous.
Yeah. You know, actually, that reminds me of a story. So, one of the experiences that I think one of the things that convinced me of this more than any other, I was lucky enough 2 summers ago to go to Venezuela for a conference, the International Encounter for the Workers' Economy, which was held and it's part of Venezuela, Punto Falcon, which is home to the world's second largest oil refinery. And we, at the conference, we met workers from all over the world, but mostly Latin America, who had either taken over businesses and taken them out of the hands of the employer and put them under worker control,
democratic worker
control, or workers who were working state enterprises in Venezuela and trying to organize to democratize the state enterprises. Because just as something's nationalized doesn't necessarily mean it's a worker democracy.
Sure.
And we met workers from this oil refinery, the world's second largest oil refinery, who told us that the place is under de facto workers' control. Because back in, I think it was 2003, Venezuelan socialism was basically paid for with oil revenues.
Right.
And so workers and the poor knew this. So in order to topple the government, the U.S. Instigated this coup attempt, as well as a strike of white-collar workers in the oil industry. So when this happened at this plant, at this refinery, the white-collar workers walked out, but the blue-collar workers wanted to keep the refinery running because they realized the state needed this revenue to run the social programs,
right,
to help the poor, to build socialism. And so they went back in the plant and began running it without any of the technical personnel, engineers, and so on. eventually this succeeded in breaking the strike of the white-collar workers. But as they came back in, the white-collar workers tried to sabotage production. And so until this day, when things break in the plant, the management doesn't allow the workers to fix stuff. And so the workers have developed a system where they're able to connect with a pipe and valve factory, which is fully under workers' control. They'll get them to make the part they need and then smuggle it into the plant. So the chances are that the gasoline you put in your car at some point, has come from a refinery, the second largest refinery in the world, which is run by workers, against a hostile management that wants to destroy it. So the question isn't, there is no question if workers' control can work. It already is working. Whether it's workers who've taken over enterprises and are running them, or whether it's just a simple reality that our places of work work because there's a million things workers know how to do that managers don't know because they don't do it. They don't do that job every day.
Sure.
And so we have the knowledge. It's just a matter of organizing as a power.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm so sorry that I've sort of kind of taken you way over the time limit that I asked for tonight. And thank you for sharing your experiences with us and your wisdom. And we wish you all the best.
Oh, thank you, Tina. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Bye bye. And that's about all the time we have for tonight, folks. Many thanks to Leah Freed, Vinny Sorrentino, Eric Foreman for sharing their experiences and wisdom with us tonight. I do hope it was helpful. Thank you to all of you out there tuning into the Heartland Labor Forum. The next up, we've got a song to play and a story from IWW songwriter and storyteller Mr. Utah Phillips. And then after that, safety first. Now we've got Dump the Bosses Off Your Back.
Well, so they decided to organize. I mean, it wasn't really a decision. It gets rammed down your throat. You can only take so much. Then I suppose it was a little easier to identify who the enemy was. The process a bit more subtle than these the waning days of Babylon. Well, of course, then you didn't have free public education, at least not for our booming people. You didn't have mass media. Well, you had songs, you had stories, and you had conversation. See, today... Well, let me put it this way. All of us assign blame in our own best interest, right? Well, if we assign blame in our own best interest, that means blame is relative. And if blame is relative, then one of the important functions in society becomes who controls the blame pattern. Why is it that large bodies of workers, like in my country, assign blame downward to some welfare chiselers down at the bottom, you know, they say, trying to get a little bit of something for nothing, and they never assign blame upward to the handful of big-time chiselers at the top that get a whole lot of something for doing nothing at all? Well, that's because the blame pattern is manipulated. Sure, through the public schools. You know, we give our kids over to that when we put them in public school. And then the public schools build in little automatic responses, levers and buttons. When they go into the labor force, you see, then the government reaches out through its media in every home and pushes those buttons and pulls those levers and elicits massive response for or against anything it chooses. Like I say, it was easier to identify who the enemy was. You're booming into the freight yards. You could see the private cars rolled off on the siding. You could see, as you were sweating underground, like in Butte, the mansions being built in a ring on the hills around. And the mansions working their way higher up the hill, the deeper you dug yourself into the ground. Okay, easy to see. And the solution was a little easier to see, too. You know, dump the bosses off your back. One thing I should mention is this music is not great poetry. You probably figured that out right away, didn't you? Well, that's because it was real simple. It had to be simple because people didn't speak a lot of English or had never been to school. But it's not like your modern protest music, which tends to be introverted. A lot of it very poetic. Hard to understand, though. Middle-class music written for middle-class consumption, because they got the bread to buy it, okay? What I'm saying, there's a lot of difference between how many miles must a white dove sail before it can rest in the sand and dump the bosses off your back. That's your line in that song, by the way, an old hymn tune, What a Friend We Have in Jesus. The Wobblies like to steal the hymn tunes because they were pretty and changed the words so they made more sense. Are you cold, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are your clothes all torn and tattered? Are you living in a shack? Would you have your troubles scattered? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are you almost split asunder? Loaded like a long-eared jack? Boob, why don't you buck like thunder and dump the bosses off your back? All the agonies you suffer, you could end with one good whack. Stiffen up, you ornery duffer, and dump the bosses off your back. Ba ba ba.
This is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, three men descend to their death from www.miamiherald.com for January 16th. An unimaginable tragedy struck in a small community in Key Largo in the Florida Keys on January 16th. Sheriff Rick Ramsey's description of the tragedy was like a stack of dominoes. The first man, the sheriff said, removed a manhole cover and went underground. Then silence. A second man climbed down in search of his coworker, and he too lost consciousness. Desperate, a third man climbed into the same hole and was immediately overcome. By the time a Key Largo firefighter climbed into the same hole in a desperate attempt to save the men, they were dead. And within seconds, the firefighter was also overcome by poisonous gas and was fighting for his life. The hole, just wide enough to fit a body and about 15 feet deep, was filled with hydrogen sulfide and methane gas, created from years of rotting vegetation. None of the four men carried the vitally important air packs that likely would have saved their lives. The firefighter decided to enter the hole without his air pack because the hole was not wide enough. Ramsey said his detectives and workers from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, will investigate. All three worked for a private Michigan-based roadwork contractor named Douglas N. Higgins, tasked with fixing a roadway. The firefighter was recently released from the hospital. In April 2002, an OSHA inspection of a Higgins project in a Marco Island manhole resulted in a $2,500 fine that got settled for $1,875. The citation said, among other violations, that atmospheric testing wasn't performed prior to and during entry, a confined space entry program wasn't implemented, confined space entry permits weren't implemented by a qualified person, a rescue plan wasn't implemented, and rescue services weren't available in a timely manner. These are all essential for working in confined spaces. Find out more information at www.osha.gov in confined spaces in the index. Finally, OSHA under Trump, a closer look, summarized from www.safetyandhealthmagazine.com for January 29th. President Trump offers the unprecedented case of an incoming commander-in-chief who has been fined multiple times by OSHA for safety violations at his work sites. His businesses have also relied on contractors and subcontractors who have been hit with major penalties. Once Trump turns his attention to OSHA, what specifically could change? Key predictions, according to labor law experts, OSHA will move away from an enforcement-based strategy and towards compliance assistance and cooperative programs for employers. OSHA funding could decrease, and the way it spends its funds could also change if Trump limits the agency enforcement budget. And recent regulations such as the Injury and Illness Record-Keeping Rule, the Silico Rule, and the so-called Blacklisting Rule all could be under jeopardy in the Trump administration. The injury and illness electronic record-keeping rule could be among the first items that Trump targets. The rule requires many employers to electronically submit injury and illness data, which could be published on the OSHA website. Anti-retaliation protections also are included in the rule, which prohibits employers from discouraging workers from reporting an injury or illness. The rule has drawn sharp criticism from some employers who claim it is burdensome and unnecessary. In July, eight industry groups filed a legal challenge to block the rule, claiming the anti-retaliation provisions unlawfully banned or limited safety incentive programs and post-incident drug testing. A judge denied the motion in November. The Silico rule published in March 2016 could be on the chopping block. The rule reduces the permissible exposure limit for respirable crystalline silica and will require engineering controls at future dates to control exposure. Both labor and business interests have dashed to the courthouse to launch lawsuits. Labor groups say that OSHA did not go far enough, and business groups say that it is not needed and not feasible. Also in jeopardy is the so-called blacklisting rule published in August, which requires firms seeking to do business with the federal government to report previous labor law violations. Meanwhile, ongoing but incomplete efforts such as the combustible dust rule and process safety management reform are unlikely to advance during the Trump administration. Not every OSHA regulation is expected to be scrapped. However, less regulation is certainly something Trump campaigned on, and OSHA presents an area with a great deal of regulation. Stay tuned. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. We have a jam-packed calendar, so I'm not going to get through it all. You can find it on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. Tomorrow morning, Friday, at 8, from 8 to 10 a.m., the Missouri Public Policy Forum, What Health and Human Services Advocates Should Know About the 2017 Missouri Legislature. It's at Founders Hall, Grace and Holy Trinity Cathedral, 415 West 13th Street in Kansas City, Missouri. Also tomorrow, in the afternoon, there's an action. KC Rejects White Supremacy, 4:30 to 6 p.m. at Oppenstein Brothers Park at 12th and Walnut downtown, sponsored by Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance, One Struggle KC, the Muslim Civic Initiative, KCQOC, and Surge KC. And President Donald Trump signed executive orders on immigration. These changes to immigration will affect thousands of families here in Kansas City and throughout the 5th District. That's why Congressman Emanuel Cleaver is having a town hall meeting about this, and there'll be speakers to inform people about what to expect. It's Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. at Manual Career and Technical Center, 1215 East Truman Road, Kansas City, Missouri. There will be Spanish interpretation. Finally, Sunday at 1 p.m., Mara Rose Williams on the Attempt to Disable Public Education, Higher to Lower. This is a program of Community of Reason, UMKC Royal Hall, room 301, 52nd and Rock Hill, Sunday at 1 p.m. And KC Interfaith Vigil for Immigrants and Refugees, Sunday at 2 to 3:30 p.m., Overland Park Christian Church, sponsored by KC for Refugees. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is going to be called Meet Trump's Cabinet Picks for Labor and Education. Thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.